Hello, I'm Stephen Fry, a trustee of the Royal Academy of Arts and very proud to be so. Welcome to our podcast.
Perhaps it's just worth talking a little bit about how we met. Our practice had entered a competition for a steamboat museum in Windermere and we were on the shortlist. It was a very hotly contested competition. A lot of very good young practices in it. We didn't win the competition and Kim was one of the jury on the competition panel. And I have a habit, if we don't win a competition, of ringing up a key individual on the panel and absolutely grilling them for over an hour, saying to them, I don't want you to tell me why, you know, that it was very close and a close thing and I nearly won. I want you to tell me why I didn't win, because next time it'll make it easier to win the next competition and to get as much good feedback as possible. And after a while he said, well, there was some criticism of the landscape aspect of your proposal. And I said, but we hardly had any landscape in our proposal. And the guy said, yes, but Kim Wilkie thought you shouldn't have had any at all. And I thought, well, he sounds like an interesting man. So on the basis of that, the next time we entered a competition, I thought it would be a good idea to get him onto our side. And we entered a competition for a small building in the beautiful grounds of Worcester College. And we brought Kim in as our landscape designer to have him on our team with those kind of opinions rather than on the jury.
And advise them to take down most of the trees.
So Kim has a very clear and tough and quite bold strategic overview of the landscape. And one of the moves we made was to extend the extraordinary Serpentine Lake in Worcester College to connect it into the wonderful buildings by McCormick, Jemison, Pritchard. And to bring our building into it as well. So the idea of the building and the landscape being seen as a single project right at the strategic stage was something that we enjoyed working on at that point. And then we got a call from you saying that we should do the Natural History Museum together.
What's always, and you'll find it this evening, what's always great about Neil is you never quite know what's coming. We actually haven't really been through this presentation yet, but what he always does is bring a kind of intellectual rigour and fantastic searching questions and then listens to the answers, which is even rarer.
I find that working with Kim, he has an extraordinary sense of the place of the landscape in a much broader cultural context. The idea, particularly in the Natural History Museum, that the kind of planting that you put in the grounds is part of a much broader system of meaning that belongs to the history of the institution, and it's possible to tell us stories about the wider world and our place in that world, has made it a really interesting and compelling collaboration. But on a more, I suppose, personal level, there are some people who you work with who give you wings, who just give you confidence. And that's something that I find working with Kim, is that I always feel as though it's possible to do something, that you can be brave when you're working with him. And I think that's been a really nice part of the collaboration. I think it might be an idea. We were going to talk a little bit in the interest that we have in the Natural History Museum itself, the thing that made us both want to do the competition in the first instance. And maybe we could start that as a way of beginning to talk about the project.
The fantastic thing about the Natural History Museum is it is actually one of the prime museums of the natural world in the world. And what constantly troubles and fascinates me is the issue of time. And we've constructed this idea of chronological time so that we really do almost persuade ourselves that one thing happens after another. But when you're dealing with geology and natural history, you realise that time is almost, although it's on a huge scale, it's almost simultaneous. So one of the things that most fascinates me is that most of what we touch has been alive at some stage. Whether it's limestone or carbon or coal, it has been alive. And something of the memory of that life lingers in the material. And something of the artificiality in our own lives is then subsumed into those. So to be able to explore how you can get from the start of the solar system right the way through to wherever we go next, and explain that both in a museum and in the grounds of the museum is what most fascinates me. And it's difficult to do, partly because we're so trained to think in chronological time. But actually, if you suspend that disbelief and think of everything as being alive all at the same time, then somehow where we're going, where we've come from, begins to make better sense.
I used to go to French lessons at the weekend in the French Culture Institute in Dublin. There were kind of catch-up lessons if you weren't very good at French. And on the window reveal outside the classroom, there was an extraordinary carving of three monkeys playing billiards. And it was the most beautiful, delicate, cheeky little carving. And as a child who knew nothing about architecture, I loved these monkeys. And they were carved by these guys who were the Smith brothers, who worked regularly with Benjamin Woodward, who had designed the Kildare Street Club, which is where I used to do my French lessons. And I wanted to talk a little bit about their place in the world and why I find them interesting. Here they are carving the window reveals in the Natural History Museum in Oxford, the Oxford Museum. And they were working with Woodward, who of course had been appointed under a huge amount of influence from Ruskin, who felt that the combination of Woodward and his wild Irish craftsmen kind of embodied his idea of the hands of the artist, the kind of living spirit of the artist being carved into the stone. But what I found out when I began to look into them more and more, there were extraordinary stories about their time in Oxford. They were familiar figures walking through the city every day on their way down to the Botanic Gardens to sketch and draw plants to bring back to carve into the window reveals. Here we see them carving one of the reveals. There's a great story where the museum ran out of money and said they would have to lay them off in a month. And they wrote a great letter in very plain English saying they were so happy carving the reveals that actually they'd be prepared to work for free, which was a great insult to the Oxford dons who had appointed them. So they were dismissed immediately. And the last thing they did was to carve animals who are caricatures of all the dons over the doorway in the museum, which is why Oxford dons have a great sense of humour, which is why if you go in there now, all the heads have been cut off, the caricatures. But I wanted to just point to this drawing, which I found in the biography of Benjamin Woodward. It's a drawing, it's a very early photograph of the capitals being carved in one of the windows by the O'Shea brothers. But look at this. The dog which he's carving into the capital has been drawn in the dust on the glass which has been put into the window frame. And so you have a photograph of a sketch of what's just about to become a carving. And I thought that's an amazing moment in the history of representation. The two great stories are that the Dean of Christchurch, when the great Darwin-Huxley debate was about to happen in the museum, that the Dean of Christchurch came and said to strike off the monkeys and to make them cats instead. And you can see these very simian cats on the window reveals, because the knowledge they were carving into the stone was absolutely, at that time in the 1850s, socially, politically, religiously, this was dangerous knowledge that was being put onto the building. The reason I talk about this is that, to me, it points to a key problem with architecture, in that this museum and the one in London are two buildings which claimed, in the way that cathedrals used to lay out the whole order of the world in a figurative fashion. In other words, the building was prepared to tell parables about the world, and that those parables would become part of the built form. And the difference is that religious knowledge had a kind of permanence and durability. It wasn't something that you expected to change all the time. But scientific knowledge is by definition completely different. It's contingent and subject to continual change. So what we know is that by the time the Natural History Museum in London had been built, it's created by Owen as a great essay against transmutation, which is the key to Darwin's ideas. And Owen's idea that you could build an essay against Darwin, it ends up being a building which, when it's built, Darwin is the great celebrity of the age. And I find that something fascinating, that the idea that the ability of buildings to tell public parables becomes much more problematic when the stories it tells, when knowledge itself is less durable and more subject to being replaced. And so that seemed to us, the idea of time and the idea of the different status of knowledge in our age, and the way that this building embodies these, seem to be two key ideas that we could take forward. The museum had a very practical problem. This is Waterhouse's drawing. You can see that the Cromwell Road here is a very open public place. There's a kid being chased by two peelers here. People are standing having a conversation in the middle of the road. So it's a public space which, you, if you know the area, is shared by the V&A. It's shared by the Brompton Oratory. And so these great civic and religious institutions are facing onto this broad thoroughfare in which people can conduct themselves socially as a civic space from which the great gateway of life opens up. But the Cromwell Road is now a huge piece of traffic infrastructure. And that creates real problems. And they're problems that we have to think about, because in effect people are no longer approaching that building in the same way as is imagined in this drawing. We just have to show Owen here. He's like a perfect Bond baddie, isn't he? A very, very interesting man. And he's been, in a sense, a bit of a victim of the success of Darwin and Huxley and his group. I think Owen was an extraordinary character in his own right. But he did sort of found his ideas on a resistance to the notion that any creature could leave its own phylum, which is then the cornerstone of the idea of natural selection, is that creatures can transform from one thing into another. And so he ends up being one of history's losers, but a very important figure in the development of natural science in the 19th century. And I suppose this is another very interesting drawing done by a non-architect. Huxley, who is Darwin's kind of key... I think he was called Darwin's bulldog sometimes. Darwin was a quiet, retiring man, had Huxley out there pushing forward strong ideas. One of his ideas, which is not necessarily to do with Darwin, but it's a very modern idea, is this one, which he has in the division of the basic structural form of the Natural History Museum into an A-B-A-B rhythm. And within the B, you get the curator's division, the realm of the specialist. And the specialist is contained in a secret world. The public are out in another division, which is where knowledge is exhibited to them in a didactic fashion. And between the two, you have these glass cases which represent the subject which is being contemplated by both parties. So the notion that knowledge here is for the expert and the specialist who keeps it to themselves and then displays it didactically is very, very different to Owen's model, where he thought the museum should be a compendium of the world. All of God's creation should be there, laid out as in a supermarket or something like that. So that the idea of specialist knowledge and the way in which it's withheld and then displayed as a kind of education is buried in the kind of bone structure of the Natural History Museum. And you can see here also the very strong structural bays within which the creatures from each phylum are strongly contained by the articulated structure and fenestration is Owen's, what Darwin's biographer calls an essay against Darwin. Beautiful drawings, first of all prepared by Owen and given to Waterhouse. We're doing a little project together which is looking at the origins of all of the drawings that were used to make the casts for the museum. And what we're finding out is that Owen started off providing all the drawings, and as he became busier and his interest waned, Waterhouse goes looking to other sources for these drawings. And they're then passed on to the draftsman from the terracotta works to be turned into casts. And what we have is in the museum, and this is absolutely critical, we have a division along the line of the central gate between everything which is extinct and everything which is extant. So time here is not flying like an arrow. Time is blocks of time. It's extraordinary for us to think about it now because we know there were 6 or 7 major extinctions. So what is extinct and extant if there were numerous extinctions? But the world is divided into, well, I would say the best word I can use for it is 2 boxes of time. That's the box of time of everything that is no longer here, and that's the box of time which is everything which is here. So time exists in this as a very deep temporal model for the building, but it's not one that we would recognise. And what we find, and this is what this diagram is, if you look at the 23rd column on the bottom on the right-hand side, the creature there is symmetrically related, the extinct creature is symmetrically related to the one on the 23rd column on the left-hand side. There's a whole spatial, symbolic, figurative system operating within the building.
And actually, Neil, it occurs to me, we're getting closer to Owen's concept in what we've done in the grounds, in that it's much less didactic, much less separated from the public, and we are trying to show them the whole of God's creation or whatever actually in the ground, so that there is something that Owen instilled into the building which is actually enforcing what we do in the grounds as well.
Yes, it's interesting that different buildings have got fundamentally different concepts of time about them. We were looking at Shinto shrines like Ise, where they are rebuilt every 20 years, so time is effectively circular. Time has a 20-year repeating pattern, and the Ise shrine, which is incredibly ancient, is also only 20 years old. And I think that, and what we've done, in a way, it's extremely difficult to continue the 19th century concept of time based on taxonomy in an era where we now think of the tree of life, of a kind of a linear development and spreading out of human life on Earth, without beginning to introduce new concepts of time into the grounds. One of the key things we're going to talk about in terms of organisation is that the building, which was on this strong axial arrangement from the Albert Hall all the way down, an axis which in a sense you can't use or really perceive if you're on the ground, but that axial arrangement which stops here is one which can't really be understood except in the symmetrical disposition of the facade of the building. And what's happening in any case is because the Cromwell Road as an effective civic or public space has more or less withered away to become a piece of traffic infrastructure, and because Exhibition Road has developed into the pedestrianised public space with the route up from South Kensington here, what's happening is that Victoria and Albert is now opening the new Boiler House courtyard here. The Science Museum has an entrance here. And what's happening is that if there was to be a there in South Kensington, it would probably be there and not here anymore. And it means that most people, and we'll look at it in a moment, are arriving into this corner of the site wanting to orientate themselves. And a significant number of them are arriving underground from South Kensington Station along the underground tunnel which makes its way up here. And they're emerging into this point wanting to find somewhere in which they can find themselves and move around the building.
And actually, looking at that again, you become aware that Exhibition Road isn't all that successful as a pedestrian thoroughfare. It's still got parking on it. And when you arrive at that corner, it is quite an uncomfortable moment where you've still got Cromwell Road rushing behind you. And so one of the first things you'll see that we felt was a priority was to make a space on that southeast corner where, as a pedestrian, you feel like it's welcome to eddy off that slightly chaotic flow.
We did an analysis of where people were arriving from, whether they're coming from Knightsbridge, from the park, from the station and so on. We worked out that about 80% of people are arriving to the site at that corner, most of them emerging up from the underground tunnel. And when they get there, they're pointing in that direction, and they're on a very narrow piece of pavement, and they're not really sure where to go. And one of the key problems that the museum has is that it's got a master plan which is going to build a new axis which goes east-west across the whole museum within the inside of it. But at the moment, it's a complete logjam. It's quite difficult to move around inside the building. And what they're saying is they're going to open up and reorganise the spatial arrangement of the inside of the building. But in order to do that, they need to use the grounds in some way to buffer that. And their ambition is to get as many... In their perfect world, 33% of people would arrive here, 33% would arrive here, and 33% would arrive here, without an extra percent in there, just to get our numbers right. But effectively, they would divide into thirds, so that people are not entering in at one end of a narrow building and then getting completely bogged down and trying to move across the building to the place they want to go. They want to use the grounds as a way of moving to the place in which you would arrive in at the nearest point. But in effect, almost no one is arriving into the museum in this direction at the moment, and that's a problem. How do you get people from there to there? And how do you orientate people and send them to the right place?
There's another problem, which in that extinct to extant bit, so on the south-west corner, at the far end of extant, they've got the dinosaur exhibition, so that needs a bit of rethinking.
This is a little sketch showing the overview of the grounds, and in general our proposal is that we will make a new square at grade level at the junction of Cromwell Road and Exhibition Road, and that square will have to respect the trees which are already in the site. It will be beside the paleontology building, which is the precast concrete building on the corner, and it will become a place for gathering. There is a drop of one story there off the square down into the grounds, and the grounds then slope up towards the main entrance. There will be a new path that runs the length of the site, and the western grounds, Kim will speak about in a moment, but they'll be about being able to come around the corner and find ways in at the Darwin Centre end. So that's just giving you a brief overview of what we proposed in the competition.
One of the things that is difficult at the moment are the levels. There's a very uncomfortable half level at the front of the building, which gets clogged up with ice rinks and fashion week and things like that. And so you arrive at street level and then look down into this pit, or you arrive from the tunnel, and a huge number of people do, and then have to climb up some sordid, smelly stairs to get to that half level, and then you're not at the museum. So one of the ways of just bringing people at street level into a green square where you can get off from the turmoil, and then from the tunnel come in directly at grade, so you don't have any steps, means that it it rather wonderfully creates a space underneath the green space where you can have a restaurant, a bookshop, things that help to support the museum without being ice rinks and fashion week. And then we'll talk a little bit more, but basically then working from the idea of this restaurant, which Neil rather wonderfully said that it should be the restaurant at the beginning of the universe. Unfortunately, the Natural History Museum starts with the solar system. The restaurant at the beginning of the solar system doesn't have the same cash flow. But anyway, you unfurl from that and then can move through from Cambrian at the change in level all the way up to the present day on the eastern side. And then you descend again to the west to move into the current situation in a metropolis, and then round the corner to the future and the Darwin Centre. We'll come into that much more, but that's the basic idea, is to take you through that sequence of time and yet make it simultaneous.
It's just worth noting that the renovation of the hall here is underway, and that's an important part of work that's being done in parallel to our work. And also this great new east-west route, which is running across the backbone of the building, is in a sense creating the loop which includes the grounds. So that's what they're thinking about doing. So our part of it is part of a larger master plan. These are just sketches from the competition document, giving a sense of what the different parts of the grounds might be like. Looking at the western grounds from the pathway beneath the trees. Looking at the main entrance, the steps making their way up to the main entranceway. And looking at the pathway that leads towards the junction with Cromwell Road and Exhibition Road. That's the V&A in the background, and the new building, which we're building, which will have a ground level square, is in the foreground there, with a little lower terrace here, which we'll see in a moment. So we've divided the site up into a number of areas. The easternmost, which is the new civic square, the eastern grounds, which are the development from the earliest time towards the present, and then the western grounds, which are dealing with, which Kim will talk about thematically in a moment. So let's just focus on the eastern square first of all. We've made a simple square. The trees need oxygen and air to their roots, and we're making a planted area around the base of the trees, across which we'll be making these bridges which come to a central square. So these are the great big plane trees which surround the site. This is the stair, existing stair, which we've little control over, which comes up and arrives facing the wrong direction. So we're saying that will exist, but from the tunnel it'll be signposted to Cromwell Road, Exhibition Road. The main signpost to the Natural History Museum from the tunnel will be at this position here, and I'll talk about that in a moment. In the centre of the square there's a very simple green area with some benches which contain roof lights. And here is a lowered court leading into a sunken area which is a pool in it, and that has got a staircase which connects the lower zone to the upper zone. This is a very simple image of the green area by the square. Once you get inside the plane trees, you can see the opportunity you have to be closer to Waterhouse's building and to begin to understand the whole kind of system of representation which is within that space. And here from that square, you can walk along this new walkway between the railings and the trees, which takes you to the very western end of the site. Here is the paleontology building in the background. And one of the opportunities we've had in the competition, we proposed to reclad this tower. But we're now in discussions about the idea of doing something else with the tower. Architecture is often seen as being constructing things, but I think architecture can also be about deleting things. And if you do that, you open up from Exhibition Road a completely new view of Waterhouse's eastern elevation. And you can see the sunken courtyard of our space will align with that elevation and make a new entrance in from Exhibition Road. This is just a little bit of an aside, a part of the project which we're not going ahead with, but which is amusing. We loved the beautiful drawings and the collections, which were made by mostly 18th century watercolour artists and scientists, the trained surveyors, on the voyages of exploration. Some of them about plants and animals, some of them about human culture. The amazing sense of encounter that you get in these drawings, and the precision of the draftsmanship, was something which we thought were very, very beautiful. And we wanted to make something of this. This is meant to be a video, but I'm afraid it doesn't work. If it was a video, the pages would just turn very slowly in the video. And our proposal was that the facade of the paleontology building, which faces the square, would be made of a scaffold which contains these representations. and that you could access these with your iPhone. So you could dial up the facade of the building and call up a book that you wanted from the collection. If you called up that book, it would appear on the facade, and you could then use your iPhone to turn the pages of your book. So while you're sitting in the square, you could watch the different pages of the different books being turned, your own page and the pages that others are turning. And so the Victor Hugo thing of the building and the book finds a certain kind of resolution here. At the lower level, coming off the tunnel, there's a little gap between the root protection area of that tree and the tower that we've taken down that allows us to sneak in. There's a World War II bunker there, so there's very little space in the basement. But we sneak in on that little line there. And we're very lucky because that sweet point between two things which we can't excavate happens to line up at the centre of the facade of the Waterhouse building. And so that gives us a little happy accident, which allows us to create a new view of the building. Looking at the overall organisation of the basement, this is kitchens and loos. This is a new restaurant looking out onto a lower terrace. This is a cloistered courtyard, which you enter into from the exhibition, from the tunnel. And that cloistered courtyard has got at the end of it a staircase. So your view from the tunnel gives you the cloister, the pool, the staircase, and the thing that you want to move towards, which is a natural history museum, which you know. It's that simple thing. When you're coming out of the underground, you're spatially in a world of diagrams. And then suddenly you come back out into the city, and your brain has to flip like night and day vision. Your brain is flipping to a different form of navigation. I always feel it's a lovely thing, if you can, to have something that you know in the view. And so we've tried to place that as soon as you come out of the tunnel, that you've got this very recognisable gable in the view.
Just while we're on that, what was really interesting, Neil, in the dialogue as how this evolved was, to start with, Neil wanted to do a huge cloister in the middle of the space there, and there was quite a lot of discussion about how unpleasant it would be to be sunk down in that space 4.5 metres below street level, and so I fought not to have a cloister, to come up and have a green square at street level, and then we were going to come up with stairs further along. And then as the project evolved, suddenly the cloister reappeared.
But it wasn't in the competition, was it?
No, it wasn't. No. It reappeared, and actually very successfully. So it's very nice the way an idea can backwards and forwards as to what would be a place that would be nice to use, good to use, and how it can then re-emerge with a stubborn
It's a long game.
So did you know it was coming back in, or it just
it just reappeared one day, and I said, Neil, you haven't forgotten that, have you? But actually, the way it works now, it works really nicely.
So actually, technically, the problem was that in the competition, we had this thing of, can you put a space one level below grade that isn't going to feel dank?
Yeah.
And so in the competition, we put it as an indoor space. But then you had a curious thing about coming out from the underground, which although the underground is technically indoors, it doesn't feel as though it's indoors. Then you come into an indoor space and then back out into the gardens. And so we were flipping back and forth. And I suppose we ended up with the idea that wouldn't it be nice to take the vaulted architecture of the tunnels, or the vaulted architecture of underground stations, and somehow allow it to blossom out into the gardens as a different kind of vaulted construction.
And when you started, you wanted that space to be planted. And I said, no, too many plants. And so it's, well, you'll see, it's mirrored water, which brings much more light in.
Kim, do you read the space in the same way that Neil just articulated it from coming out of the underground?
Yeah.
I mean, is your reading the same? It's quite an architectural description, I'm wondering if...
What I love best is that we're actually looking at it from completely opposite ends. But actually the language then and what we come up with does then work. But it's, I think what's most stimulating is to look at a problem from opposite ends, and you reach a place that you'd never get to on your own. And I think that's, if you're able to take the somersaults and the leapfrogs together, then you reach a place that neither of you would have got to before. And because I'm constantly thinking what it's like to be outside, and Neil is thinking more of the interiors, then there's that that nice friction that works well.
But there is a little bit, isn't there? When we have a problem to solve, I'll go, let's have a building, and you go, let's have a garden, which is fair enough. But I mean, in a way, the best decisions are the ones where that has gone back and forth.
You were saying, let's have a garden. I said, no, let's have a building. So it can, but you're right. Yeah. That there are preferences that you come with, or ways of seeing that you come with. But
in this area particularly, there's no way we would have arrived at this. I think it was something that was genuinely arrived at together.
Completely, yeah.
So this is just giving you a sense of the section. In the restaurant, we have the roof lights coming down from the square to illuminate the space, which then looks out into the grounds. And then this is the cloister, which aligns with, which has got the pool, which you can look down into from the upper space. And at the end of that, there is the staircase. This is giving you a long section, looking at the way in which the trees are coming out of this area, the bridge is coming over. This is the tunnel. We're looking here through the bookshop. The bookshop has been positioned on the south side of the cloistered space, so you get sunlight coming into the north side. So it's coming in from the south into the north, into the north cloister. And then the south cloister, which is facing north, has got all the books. So the books give the life and light to one side, and the sunshine comes into the other side. And then this is the cafe, and this is where the kind of vaulted world of the tunnel, turns out. And then this is looking at it in the other direction, so you have the cloister itself, you arrive in from the tunnel, this is the tunnel here, you arrive in from the tunnel, you have the pool, the stair, and then the garden, and then this becomes a way out, either up to the upper square or straight out into the garden. And there's a ramped path here which stretches up, which we'll talk about in a moment. And this is a lovely 16th century vaulted structure, which we wanted to just show and say that it's been a picture in the office that we've always really enjoyed. And another scheme by Lacaton Vassel in Vienna for a vaulted, decorated tiled ceiling, which we loved. We haven't shown the decoration on this vaulting, but it's something that we're working on at the moment. There are going to be two things. Kim, do you want to talk a little bit about the pool?
Yeah. The idea here was that because you're coming out of a dark space and you want as much light in there as possible, it would be good for ferns and fungi and so on. But actually, if you can bounce light off water and get reflection off it, it means that as you come out of the underground, your view goes up to the building. But when you're on the square up above, you can look down into the water, and it's only a film of water. And underneath it then are stones with the beginnings of life abstracted into it. So when you're looking down, you see something very different from what you're seeing from below. And I think that ability to take a second look at something and be intrigued by what's going down, and then have this notion of time spiralling out from the restaurant around and then out to the geological wall we'll talk about in a bit.
So you'd wanted to put water in, is that right, for a while in the early...
I did.
Yep.
But actually, for once, Neil was going for plants.
But the idea of the light reflecting up off the water was something which in that space there, I think that in a way the danger is that that space would feel a bit dank, so why not fill it with water? I mean, I think it needed to have something that would give it a very positive attribute. There's a possibility that the water would give us wonderful reflections of the building itself, because I think that there'll be a kind of, it's not so strong on that image, but there'll be a kind of a doubling of the cloister. And that the light coming off the water, which is coming in from the south side, which is on our left, will catch that water and then lift that light back up into the underside of the vaults on the right-hand side of the image. And I like the idea that when you come in here that you might see the water as a surface with reflections, but as you see it from the top that you see down into it, and there's something just beneath that surface which is a whole other representation of early life. Just to remind you that although, in a sense, Owen's conception of what I've called two boxes of time belongs to the sort of 19th century idea of taxonomy, that we really needed to engage with some notion of development through time, or that there was a linear development through time. And so we felt that the very eastern edge of the site should represent the sort of starting of the clock in the temporal model that we have of the grounds. And so one of the things we wanted to do was to engage with what to me is still one of the most extraordinary mysteries, which is how a geologically active planet can become a biologically active planet. And what we realise now is that geological activity is the driver for biological activity. And it's that moment when the most primitive life forms emerge from the basic kind of chemistry that we thought would be really interesting to look at it, partly because it's about complexity emerging from some extremely simple sets of terms in the first instance. And we thought that in terms of kind of architectural embellishment of the building, it was a very interesting problem to look at. So
the other thing is that our understanding of evolution, how rapidly and how it happens and how it can happen in real jumps, is changing by the day almost. So that notion that evolution has been a very gradual process is being re-understood now. And I think allowing those to fit within the pattern is and all sorts of future discoveries to fit within the pattern is quite a nice challenge.
One of the issues that we had at the start of this, and it's an interesting thing about our present architectural culture, is I heard this story about Oxford when the O'Shea brothers were carving the window, and Ackland walked up to them one day and he said, "This guy Darwin is telling a story about a bear who's going around on the surface of water and taking flies off the surface of the water." And he's then saying that somehow or other that bear becomes, or that the relationship between that bear and a whale, and you know the book Almost Like a Whale, so that this comes from this. But Ackland, way, way before any of that, says to the O'Shea brothers, what sort of creature would that, you know, he's trying to think about how a bear and a whale could be related. So he leaves it to the mason and comes back, and there in the window reveal of the museum, you have this carving, which is kind of like a bear and kind of like a whale. And so you have this incredible immediate connection between Ackland and the O'Shea's. Apparently, the architect had gone away on 2 weeks' holidays, and Ackland thought he could sow a bit of mischief in his absence. But here's science being done, new ideas emerging, and there's this guy standing with his chisel ready to have a go. And I thought that was an amazing moment in history. And we felt for this that what we wanted to do was to put up something which might in the future have some of the pathos of Waterhouse's building. Here's something that people once thought. Imagine that. We do think it now, but what will they think of that in 200 years' time? And also, what we wanted to do was to get through the first year of working on this project. I think it's fair to say we had to try and find a way of working with, but getting through a layer of abstraction that now exists in the process of procuring buildings. That there are so many people who are there to manage the relationship between the architect, the designer, and the very broad constituency of consultees in the museum and so on, and try and find a way through to those people who have ideas. And so recently we've set up now a little workshop with some key people in Imperial College, in UCL, and the Natural History Museum, who are really thinking about the relationship between geometry, crystalline order, and the origins of life. And we as a treat are going to have workshops with these guys and try and work out a way of proposing a system of decoration that will allow us to think of the emergence of complex form from simple form, and for it to be kind of viable and current. And so, you know, our thinking about it in simple terms is about the origin of complex cells from simple cells. We know that for billions and billions of years, there were bacteria and there were other primitive cell forms which were not moving fast. We know that there are complex theories about how they came together to form more complex cells, and how those complex cells then worked to form things like photosynthesis and so on. So these extraordinary diagrams that are showing in very simple form how that emerged is something that we want to look at. And we want to look, generally speaking, at the geometry or the emergence of complex form from simple forms, both in terms of graphic representation, but also in terms of scientific knowledge. And these beautiful kind of images here of early life forms are things that we're using as our inspiration. And at the end of the day, because we're interested in the digital production of decoration through precast concrete, we have this as a kind of, can we do anything like as well as that? And this image from the Alhambra is something that we think is something that we want to hold up as, wouldn't it be fantastic if you could make something that lived up to some of that sort of sense of richness? This is the cafe, which is a simple vaulted structure opening out into the garden at the right. And you can see as you open up towards the garden that you then get the view up towards the main entrance. This is a little building we designed in Boston for Vidal Sassoon, but it has vaulted structures on the inside, and so we're using some of that kind of thinking to create an idea of a vaulted structure that opens out towards the garden.
So he keeps on calling it the garden, but actually it's the grounds.
Sorry, Ken.
That's right. And what, as you emerge from the restaurant, you then have this long walk, gradual walk, up to the entrance, of the main entrance of the museum. And so in the retaining wall, because we've dug down quite deep, the the strata, the geological strata, will be represented in that wall that you can see at the end of the picture there. And you can walk accurately how we think time has evolved through the various epochs with the big cataclysmic events. But from that, to give a sense of what vegetation has emerged at the same time, there will be, at the very beginning, there will be the equisetums and the cycads and the ferns. And among all the people that we talk to, there are 300 scientists inside that building. And so there's a kind of ritual humiliation every fortnight when you are explained that no, dinosaurs didn't eat grass, and grass didn't evolve till much later. So actually working out with them what to show and how to show it, and sort of suddenly they'll come up with this wonderful idea that as you get in from the ferns into the angiosperms and the flowering plants, why not represent it by Asteraceae, which is the biggest family after orchids, and why not have a meadow of asters and dahlias? And so suddenly you can work with the scientists to come up with extraordinary, vivid representations, and you can walk through that life, and because it's strata, you can actually see how Carboniferous sits over, I'm not going to say whatever it sits over, but basically you get that sense that it is all there present in this tiny crust of the earth, and you can walk through it and realise that it's all part of our life and the natural world. And of course, Dippy comes, the dinosaur comes out of the main hall and grazes on cycads as you're sitting grazing on watercress. So yes, that's what I've just been describing. And again,
that's the detail. But the key thing to recognise is that this path is level from the upper square connecting to the main entrance, and this path is sloping up from the lower terrace.
And that wall that I've been talking about is the one that divides the two. So that's where you get that sense of everything being on top of everything else, and it all having been alive at some stage in this tiny, tiny crust of the planet which makes life possible. And then it decomposes to form topsoil, which is what we completely depend on to live, and which is what the Western Garden explores.
I heard we made this as a kind of a strong graphic image, but I was told that some of the scientists were very upset that we have to find the way that each of the rocks beds down properly and not be treating them as some kind of graphic construction. So we're going to have to work through very carefully how each of those rocks would lie or fold or have been faulted or have been twisted to make sure that that's correct and accurate. The central entrance is really just a very simple technical problem, which is how do you get parity of experience for people with pushchairs and wheelchairs entering the main gateway of life? Because there's a rather beautiful set of stairs which interrupts the great ramps which take you up to the level of the entrance, and those stairs are part of the gateway itself. And so we've had to think very, very carefully about how we arrange to get pushchair and wheelchair access up there, and of course it's got to come right past these very, very delicate carvings at the entrance to the museum. And so these are just technical questions of how we raise the steps and negotiate with English Heritage to make sure that everybody has the same chance to come right through the main entrance of the museum and to resist the strong push to create some kind of basement entrance with a lift up. It would be wonderful if we could, without ruining the doorway, to make it possible for everyone to flow through that central processional entrance. And so this is just technically thinking about how it might be done. It's very detailed, so I think we won't take you through all that. From there, you're looking towards the Western grounds.
I'm going to go through this really rapidly, because I think there should be time for more discussion. But the basic principle of the Western grounds is that you then descend down to a huge kind of dew pond that collects the water off the roof and cleans it. And the message is, how do we survive in the biggest city in Europe beside one of the busiest roads? What is the recipe for living with nature and staying sane within cities? Because 90% of us in Britain now live in cities. And so it's to do with water, to do with soil, to do with air. And in these ritual humiliation meetings with the scientists, they have some horrible phrases like ecosystem services, which basically how the planet makes it possible for humans to live. We've shifted into eco systems, how the planet manages to keep itself alive. And so in that process, you'll walk down through a meadow that ranges from dry alkaline plants, chalk meadows, down to this wet pool. Is it worth flicking on? I'm not sure what the edge. Yes, to this huge pool that's cleaning water, and then rise up to the Darwin Center through a series of three terraces that will explore not only the ecological systems, but actually human psychology and how human beings relate to plants and nature within cities. And I think we can flick on again. Those are the meadows, and on again. And so you will get this sense entering from Queensgate, isn't it? Queensgate, yes. Of an upper pond, a lower pond, and these terraces that explore all of the ways that the natural world and human beings can function together within a city, and whether we'll survive or not. I think that's the last slide, isn't it? Yes.
I mean, I think it's worth saying that this is really work in progress. I would be surprised if we ended up with exactly this version of the scheme. There's so much that's being negotiated and in transition. But I think that it was just to give you a sense of how we've been thinking about the different parts.
The idea of negotiation, I think, is quite an interesting... You know, you're negotiating with the building, you're negotiating with the planners, you're negotiating with one another, you're negotiating with history and site. But I think you've still got... We had this conversation a little bit before, actually, about the strength of a conceptual idea that you hold to, and that both of you have a sense of... It's a shared commonality of what you're holding on to, isn't it, with this scheme and where you negotiate.
I think we think about that slightly differently. I mean, I think that it actually helps us in the way that we negotiate. I think that... because there are two poles of thinking about it. One of them is that the act of authorship is to come up with an extremely strong idea and to make sure that you have the determination and resources to carry that idea complete through to its execution, or else the thing will just have the hell battered out of it and you might as well not do it. The other is a kind of notion of staying on the fly a bit and seeing how things move and waiting for the idea, or sometimes to treat the idea as a forlorn hope that you send it in to test the defences and then find out what the real idea coming after it is. So the notion of things, the notion of a simple concept being driven through in all its simplicity, and the notion of the kind of negotiated version of it, making it up as you go along, is something that we play back and forth, both with each other, but I think also there's a huge amount of public and internal consultation on this. And I would like to say that everybody is completely delighted with everything that we're doing. It's not that simple. And we're having to find ways to tough it out, but also to push and pull and negotiate.
I'm the stubborn one that sticks with the first idea. And Neil is actually the one who's extremely flexible and works around all sorts of ways through it. Do you think that's fair?
My inner stubbornness is just, it's just withheld stubbornness, I'm sure. But I think it's interesting that everybody who has a strong instinct to make and design things has that stubbornness at some level in them. And it's actually different ways of articulating it, I think. Because I think that you don't have... I think there are a few people who make successful things who don't have a very strong ego as an author. And part of collaboration, part of consultation, is how you deploy it, how you deploy that ego. I think it doesn't work if you deny it. I think that you have to find ways of kind of managing that beast in a way. And part of us collaborating is a kind of moments of withdrawing the claws and going into open dialogue, and then moments of sort of digging in and insisting. And the little microcosm of that conversation has to then be played out on a much larger public stage, where you're listening to... I think we have a range of voices that have suggested that every single thing we've done... I've heard that every single thing we've done is amazing, and I've heard that every single thing we've done is absolutely awful and almost criminal. And the point about it is nobody gives the same opinion about each thing. The person who likes that one hates the other one, and so on. So you've got to find a way of being certain about what you're doing, but also being flexible enough to make sure that people for whom these grounds are the most important things in their lives are also being listened to.
But you describe stubbornness in a way that when you speak about going to a place, I want to talk a little bit about how you describe a place or going to something, because you know, the book Led from the Land, You say you spend a lot of time in a place, and it's understanding what that is in a physical form, cultural form, emotional response. And thinking about a site like this, how wide is your that sense of place you're gaining? And, you know, I think you can word say place, and to my mind it might be very much like this, but I think as a landscape architect you think about place in quite broad terms. Is that correct?
Yes. I think that's one of the nice things, is that I think landscape architects tend to come from looking almost at the whole planet and then coming in and focusing in on the place. And architects are much better at looking at the detail and working out. And that sort of crossing over has worked very well, and partly because I think you tell stories and you understand stories extremely well. And so that weaving of stories around a place and a situation makes it come alive and stops it from being too leaden. But I think the other thing is that as a landscape architect, you feel a responsibility for the place and the history of the place. And it's a mute voice that you have to dig out and represent. And often the biggest conversation is with the client, the person who's actually making the project happen, saying, actually hold back and respect the place that you're dealing with and modify your ideas to work with the place that you're dealing with. And actually, I think if you do that with a kind of conviction and clarity, it works. I mean, and there are notable examples when it doesn't and you get thrown off the job. But when you don't, then it's actually much richer, because everyone then has an understanding of the subtlety of what one is dealing with, and of also the span of time that it encompasses, and that we are just a moment in that long process.
How do you think about time, Neil?
Well, I was trying to think about place for a moment, and we set a subject for our students a few years ago. The title was Emerging and Dissolving Landscapes, and the idea that places that you look at that appear to be static in that moment or appear to have an enduring character are constantly in a process of becoming and dissolution, and that because that process is often slower than our imagination will hold it, we see it as having a kind of a permanence. But I love the idea that the stability of place is not as its stability may be different if you think about it in time. That a place is also something that is negotiated over time, and that those negotiations are the things that are, both contained and shed, and I'm interested in how that process occurs. So I always want to think that the thing that we're doing is you know the from the sketch to the ruin. The architectural conception is always existing as a kind of a temporal phenomenon, and the stability of form, or the given identity of the image of the architecture or the form of the architecture, is far more contingent and unstable than we think it is. And so if that's an answer, I like to think that what we're doing here, which we set down and delineate with a degree of certainty, is part of a kind of something which is much more cloud-like and shifting over time. I suppose that's how I think about it.
But one thing you're really good at is possibly the thing that lingers with a place is the stories that are told about it. They're the ones that connect it through. They're the ones that, though they're constantly changing, have the continuing life. And your ability to plumb those and retell them is very good.
But also to potentially put them within to bring them out in the architecture, to embody them in something. So it's not just using language, it's using building. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but in a way, language is a funny function in that, doesn't it? Because at the end of the day, we'll tell all of these stories to all of you, and we'll design all of this, and then we'll put this thing in place, and it'll have to be, we'll give it away, and it'll have to be read in all sorts of ways. And I think one of the things that we're in dialogue with the museum, because a museum have got very good and very interesting departments that are about public communication, and there's always a desire, perhaps on our part, but also on their part, to over-tell the story or to over-specify the meanings. And to go back to something I frequently say, I think that the purpose of what we're doing is not to communicate meaning literally, but to create a space where meaning can be read, and to create something that has the kind of conceptual bagginess that you can enter into it and be drawn by form or be drawn by situation into your own contemplation of notions of time and change and the status of knowledge and models of the world, but not to have that excessively didactic or directive way of reading this.
Because it was one aspect of the competition, wasn't it? I think they said something like that the ground could contribute to the interpretive program at the museum. And that's quite an inspiring line in a brief, because very often it's pragmatic and there's a lot of things to deal with about people's experience in it, but actually it is saying that this ground has a contribution to make towards actually how people understand not just the museum, but actually what the museum represents, which is, I think, why you seem to do that in the concept of, you know, your concept does that. And that's what you're pushing. I mean, that's what you're holding forth to, isn't it? Mm.
But I think something that's happened with museums maybe in the last while is that they have, to some extent, I'm not saying this one in particular, but many museums have become excessively interpretive.
Yep.
And I look at the slide that Kim started with of the creature's skeletons in the Victorian in the Victorian hall, and I feel that I remember as a child going into the museum in Dublin, which was actually much more like Owen's conception. It's just a big hall stuffed with strange skeletons. And I don't remember reading or interpreting anything, but I felt like I was in a thicket of bone. It was an amazing place that you would just wander through as a child. And knowledge came to you by touch, by immersion. And so the notion that ideas are in things rather than having to be kind of permanently communicated and interpreted for you, there's a sort of opportunity that's going to come up, I suppose, in the museum are thinking about it, which is that we'll no longer have huge sort of papier-mâché and tinfoil constructions telling us about geology, but you'll have gems and rocks or skeletons and plants, and then you'll just carry your iPhone or your tablet around. And if you wish to find 50 purple things in the museum, you can. Or if you wish to go into the deep cellular structure of the movement from bacteria and such, you can. And that maybe the space and the exhibits and the objects will be given room to breathe again.
Michael Portillo was on the jury, and his one question was, why will anyone come to the Natural History Museum in 50 years' time? And because it's gone so much down the line of virtual reality, mm-hmm. and at that point, you might as well watch it at home, and why put up with the queues? And I think we answered that you'll go there for something real. And I was particularly struck recently at the National Portrait Museum, when they had objects with the Tudors so that you could see Henry VIII's rosary, how big it was, how covered in the fat from his hands it was. And suddenly those two-dimensional images connected in a kind of vibrating way with something that he had touched with so much emotion, and it shrunk the distance of the time. And I think being able to see stuffed animals, the bones, I think it'll make it a place that's worth going to, just to absorb as you want to, not being too didactically taught about it, just getting a sense of how extraordinary the natural world is.
And I think, Neil, your point about it holding a particular moment, I mean, I think that Owen's conversation, or position against Darwin, the extinct, the extant, I mean, that you can only really discover in the building, and you sort of do uncover it, even if you don't know it. It's sort of, you have the sense that it has been laid out with that sort of intention in it, which is an interesting experience. I mean, that's part of the experience of it too.
There's a very interesting man, Dr. John Holmes, who we were introduced to through the museum, and he's writing a book at the moment about the pre-Raphaelites and art. And he's done a beautiful chapter which is on the relationship between the Oxford Museum and the London one. And what he said is that because Ruskin is driven by this Gothic ideal of the hands of the craftsman and so on, and he's bringing these craftsmen in as though they were Gothic masons to carve the building. They're going out and observing nature, and they're creating these carvings in which that bird is flying out from those reeds. It's preying on that snake and by that water. So in a sense, what he's done is to create in his carving, and the naturalism of his carving, a kind of ecology. while Waterhouse is using mechanical means to stamp out all of its decoration. So that bird is no longer lost in the thicket of the things around it. That bird has been isolated on a plate as though it were a specimen. And so he says it's quite interesting that this strongly kind of categorical idea of taxonomy, of isolating the creature as a specimen to be seen by itself, which is one idea of knowledge, is being related to this kind of future of the idea of industrialized production of architectural form, while this very almost sort of 20th, 21st century scientific knowledge of ecology is being drawn back into this kind of Gothic form of representation. And it's as though you have two forms of representation and two notions of scientific knowledge which kind of cross each other within the space of about 10 years. It's really fascinating.
And talking to the scientists, there are moments where suddenly they understand what we're going on about. And there was a great moment last week where they said, so in the extinct bit, it is all about straight lines and a linear progression. And in the extant bit, it's entirely about circles. There's no direction. It is just coming back. And so suddenly they really liked the fact that one was quite linear and straight, and the other was much more curvaceous and returning back on itself. There are nice ways that you can get subliminal messages across like that. So as Neil says, you're not saying this is how it happens, but this is what it feels like to be part of the system.
And then I think you can experience it and then even learn, you know, echoes with you later as your knowledge develops as well of it. Are you, had Waterhouse thought much about the landscape around? You know, is there anything, you know, there's a lot of discussion about the building. Was there discussion about the thought of how this had been laid out?
There are two things. One is that he did a fairly typical Victorian municipal layout at the front, which was relatively symmetrical, but I think didn't put much thought into it. But the other thing, which happens a great deal, is by the time they got round to the landscape, the money had run out. So actually not much, not even his sketch really happened there. And there were just practical issues, like an awful lot of buildings in London are created by digging out the ground and piling it on the street. So that's part of the reason why you've got that funny twilight half zone between the building and the street that we're trying to resolve.
But I think the museum themselves feel that after that, everything that happened was a sequence of events that were not planned events.
Yeah.
So that the generation of the current state of the grounds is not something that they can see in any way as having been intended.
Yeah,
and from their point of view, it's the first time that they want to think about the grounds in a completely holistic way.
Yeah.
And the key thing for them is they want to feel as though as soon as you're in the grounds, you're in the museum. So the museum is no longer just the building, which it slightly is at the moment. They want to feel that you enter into the museum at the moment that you leave the pavement and so on. Yep.
One of the fascinating things that happened with the project was the competition was actually run by the Estates Department trying to sort out functional things like queuing. And very quickly it transferred to the Public Engagement Department to actually be much more about education and how the whole lot fits together conceptually.
Just got one final question. You spoke about Neil's ability to tell stories and how compelling it is. And when we met before, we were also having a chat about how you like quite often will hold off, say, doing a drawing, because a drawing can be quite fixed, particularly in giving it to somebody. People imagine it is a sort of static thing, where a story is one in which you can enter and it becomes more fluid, I think. So I'm wondering about how the two of you work together. Is it through, I mean, does storytelling become quite important in this?
We like to chat.
He is Irish. I think it, I mean, not only, I think we talk more than we draw, actually, don't we? Chris, the bat, does all the drawing. But I find, particularly when I'm dealing with the British, that the best way to get an idea across is with the right words, and to your imagination is stirred by words much more profoundly than by images. By the time you've got to the image, you've cut out a lot of the imagination. So I think words are incredibly powerful, and if you can get those right and then begin to translate them into something drawn and then something physical, it possibly has the process of getting from the word to the physical also takes the imagination of everyone who's involved with it along with them. I love words.
I think also in terms of our conversations with scientists, very often when you put something down as a visual form, that's interpreted in a very specific way,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
That, for example, a circle might be seen as not being natural,
yeah,
or a square might be seen as not being natural, and you know, is the natural world not better represented by things that are not geometrically... So, not necessarily with all of them, but certainly with some.
Yeah.
So, and in a sense, the circle or the square is something that you might not in much of a way experience when you're there as being your primary experience of the building. But when you see it on an architectural plan, God, it's something that you really focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes, in that sense, the representation, you need to be quite careful that the representation is actually embodying what it is that you want the place to be like eventually. And I think that's been something we've needed to be quite thoughtful about.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing about it is, the building still goes back to that funny problem that we've got, which is that a Gothic cathedral is a sermon in stone. It's God's order of the world represented in a huge stone edifice. And Waterhouse tried to do that. He tried to make a building. Owen and Waterhouse wanted to say, in the way that the cathedral was once a model of the world, this building is a model of the world. And even if now we understand the difficulties of his conception, the echoes of that proposal and the ambition of that proposal remains in the site. And you've got to somehow try to measure yourself against it and say, although we're only working on the margins of that great building, we somehow have to offer some answer to the fact that it tried to be a model of the world in a time when models of the world are much more difficult to produce and much more difficult to offer with integrity. I think it's quite a difficult problem.
Thank you both for sharing this project. And I think that one has a sense that it is still alive, and what will happen, and when will we see it? When will it be finished? The ultimate question.
When someone gives the money to build it.
Well, let's hope, and I think it'd be interesting to see what happens in that time as to, you know, as you say, science evolves, the world around us evolves. So thank you very much both for sharing it, and good luck, and continue to enjoy those conversations. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more information about the Royal Academy, please visit www.royalacademy.org.uk.